Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Hosea chapter 3. It's just five verses long. I will entitle it, Hosea Redeems His Wife. And this is going to be a type or a prophetic object lesson of God redeeming his people through Jesus the Messiah. Again, Hosea is prophesying in the 8th century B.C., sometime before the destruction of the northern kingdom in 722 B.C. We start now in Hosea chapter 3, verse 1. Then the Lord said to me, Go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. Now this is God speaking to Hosea. The Lord said to me, Hosea, I got another job for you. You need to love a woman who is loved by her husband. Well, who is this woman? Well, it's not another woman. It's the same Gomer, as the commentator Gabelin says, and so does Barnes, and so does the NASB note. I don't think that's controversial. I guess you could say it's another woman, but no, we're going to keep it simple. It's Gomer. Go again and love Gomer, who was loved by her husband. Now, that translation there is iffy. Some translations have a woman who is loved by her friend. The American Standard Version, the Darby Translation, the King James Version, the Young's Literal Translation all have friend. Love a woman who is loved by her friend. Well, what does that mean? Well, it could mean that Gomer is loved by Hosea. Hosea is her friend. Or it could be Gomer is loved by her husband because Hosea is her husband. Now, the Bible in Basic English has it just like the NASB. Husband, the God's Word translation, has others, who is loved by others. Sounds like she's a whore. In other words, it's not just one paramour she's committing adultery with, but a bunch of them. The Holman Christian Study Bible has a woman who is loved by another man. That would be the man that Gomer was committing adultery with. The New American Bible has, go love a woman who was loved by her paramour. So, it doesn't really matter. The point is, Gomer was either loved by Hosea or she was loved by the man she was cheating with. Because in the very next phrase, verse 1 says, she is yet an adulteress. Now we've already shown, starting in chapter 1, she was already a prostitute at some point in her life. And Barnes says now she's living in adultery with another man after marrying Hosea. So the way Barnes has it is, she's a prostitute, Hosea marries her, she quits being a prostitute, but then she goes out and starts committing adultery with other people. Well, there are lots of options as to what Gomer's particular state of sin was. Here's option number one. She was already married to Hosea as a prostitute, and then she cheated on Hosea with another man after she had had Hosea's three children, Jezreel, Lo, Ruhamah, and Lo Ami. Here's option number two. She was a prostitute. She had married another man before Hosea. Then she cheated on the first husband before Hosea bought her. He's going to buy her in just a minute. And so then Hosea had his three kids after taking her as a wife. And then, of course, there's the options as to what kind of a prostitute or when she was a prostitute. Was she a prostitute at the time she married Hosea? Was she a prostitute but then quit being a prostitute when she married Hosea, so she was a reformed prostitute when she married Hosea? Was she pure up until the time she married Hosea and then decided to become a prostitute after she had married Hosea? The permutations and combinations are endless, and the commentators argue, and I really don't care. The point is, she was a sinful woman, and yet Hosea loved her. And of course, the analogy is to Israel. Israel was a sinful people, and yet Yahweh still loved her. The connection is made obvious in verse 1. She is loved by her husband, yet as an adulteress, Gomer is, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods. There, the connection between Gomer's physical adultery and Israel's spiritual adultery is made explicit. Now, one last comment on verse 1. Israel is said to turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. What's the big deal about loving raisin cakes? Well, raisin cakes were used in idolatrous worship, and that's what the reference is to. We go now to verse 2 of Hosea 3. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. First question, why did Hosea have to buy his own wife? Well, here are a couple of options. This is option number one from Guzik. Hosea paid the money to Gomer as a display of love and commitment. He goes the extra mile beyond what is expected or even reasonable. In providing this way for his own wife, Hosea also showed her, I can give you what the others can. You don't need them. I don't believe Guzik is right there. Bought sounds like a transaction, not like a bribe or not like a gift. When you buy somebody, you pay the owner. She was a slave. And not only that, he paid such a cheap price for her, it really wasn't showing any kind of honor to her at all, as Guzik claims. Benson actually sort of agrees with Guzik. Benson says that this was a dower payment. That's what the old commentators call what actually legally was a curtsy. When a man paid a marriage price, it was a curtsy. At least in medieval times, it was a curtsy. And so Hosea is said to be giving a marriage price to Gomer so he could marry her. Now, it doesn't say who he paid. It sounds to me like he paid the paramour or paid the other husband that she was catting around on. It depends on how you interpret verse 1. But he paid somebody. Like Jacob had to give Laban labor service in order to get Rachel and Leah. So Benson's idea, this is the same marriage price custom. The commentator Boyce, that's B-O-I-C-E, he says that Gomer had been sold into slavery and Hosea bought her out of slavery. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that Gomer was the slave of her paramour, and I think that's exactly what happened, in my humble opinion. At any rate, it doesn't really matter. What really matters is the price that he paid for Gomer, 15 shekels of silver. That wasn't even the full price of a slave, of a common slave. Exodus 21:32 says, if the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver. But Hosea was only offering 15 shekels of silver for Gomer. That's how cheap and degraded she was. He also paid a homer and a half of barley. Barley was the food of animals, as Barnes points out. It shows her degradation. She was worthless, just like Israel was. The barley offering, according to Gabelin and Barnes, reminds one of the offering that had to be made by one accused of adultery in the adultery ritual in the law. Again, that shows her degradation. That's just sort of a hint of barley. Barley was the cheap grain. Wheat was the expensive grain. So in verse 2, Hosea buys Gomer for cheap. We go now to verse 3 of Hosea 3. Hosea speaks. He says, then I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be toward you. Now this staying for many days means to dwell alone in some solitary and separate place and have no conversation with any person, especially with men. John Gill says she was to wait for a long time till the prophet should think fit to take her to his house. She had to go through a probation period of chastity, basically, because in verse 3, Hosea says, you shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. In other words, you're not going to whore around with anybody, and you're not going to marry anybody either. And notice that included Hosea. He wasn't going to have anything to do with her either. As Benson points out, not even Hosea was to have her. And Benson also says, Gomer isn't going to have a husband, and Hosea is not going to be her husband. And Ellicott points out this, of course, is meant to be temporary. Of course, it's temporary. A probation period of chastity. Now, of course, you're going to wonder, why in the world did Hosea do this? Well, we'll see why in verse 4. Hosea chapter 3, verse 4 reads this way, for the Israelites must live many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. Now, what in the world is the connection with verse 3? What's the connection of verse 4 with verse 3? For the Israelites, because the Israelites. In other words, I'm holding Gomer in seclusion for the reason that the Israelites live many days without king or priest. Here's the connection. Gomer was deprived of a husband in verse 3, and Israel is going to be deprived of prophet, priest, or king in verse 4. Well, let's go through verse 4 and see that. For the Israelites must live many days without king or prince. Well, there's the king. Without sacrifice. Well, that's what priests do. Now, not only is Israel going to be deprived of legal sacrifices, but also illegal sacrifices. Without sacrifice or sacred pillar or image, as some translations have, idols. So there's no priestly function, either legal or illegal. And without ephod, of course, the Israelites used the ephod, had the Urim and Thummim in it, in the breastplate. They used that for prophetic usages. When God was supposed to speak to them, they would use the ephod. That's the legal way of prophecy, or household idols, teraphim. That's the illegal way of knowing God's will. So the function of prophet, priest, and king, both legal and illegal, gone. The Israelites must live many days without king or prince. Now, I'm going to read you some quotes from Albert Barnes, the second of which is really wonderful, but just to reinforce this idea of the deprivation of Israel from the services of prophet, priest, and king, Barnes says this: as the wife waited for her husband, kept apart under his care, yet not acknowledged by him, not following after idolatries, yet cut off from the sacrificial worship which he had appointed for forgiveness of sins, through faith in the sacrifice yet to be offered, that's referring to Jesus, cut off also from the appointed means of consulting him and knowing his will. So there's two aspects to this sequestering of Gomer. One is she's cut off, but on the other hand, she's preserved, and she's not wiped out. She's preserved for the time of redemption, when Hosea is going to redeem her. And of course, the analogy is this: Israel is going to be wiped out, basically, 722, 586. But God's going to redeem Israel with the new Israel, i.e. the Church of Jesus Christ. Now I'm going to read you a quote from Barnes, which is probably the best quote of any commentator I've found in all of these years of doing this podcast. I'm going to read this to you to point out the two aspects of this sequestering of Gomer. She's preserved, but she's cut off. She's preserved by God, but she's cut off from God. So let me read from Barnes' quote: oppressed, released, favored, despised, or aggrandized in East or West, hating Christians, loving to blaspheme Christ, forced, as they would remain Jews, to explain away the prophecies which speak of him, which speak of Christ, deprived of the sacrifices which to their forefathers spoke of him and his atonement, still, as a mass, they blindly wait for him, the true knowledge of whom, his offices, his priesthood, and his kingdom, they have laid aside. He has preserved them from mingling with idolaters or Muslims. Oppression has not extinguished them. Favor has not bribed them. He has kept them from abandoning their mangled worship or the scriptures which they understand not and whose true meaning they believe not. They have fed on the raisin husks of a barren ritual and unspiritual legalism since the Holy Spirit they have grieved away. Yet they exist still, a monument to us of God's abiding wrath on sin, as Lot's wife was to them, encrusted, stiff, lifeless, only that we know that the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. There's the tragedy of the Jewish race. Messiah landed right in the midst of them, and they were so blind they rejected him. Now, of course, there's a lot of Jews coming to Christ now, being grafted back into the olive tree, and may there be millions and trillions more. But it really is a shame how the official rabbis of the Jewish religion just refuse to see that the Messiah has already come. So Israel is going to be protected like Gomer, and yet cut off from the functions of prophet, priest, and king. And this is going to last many days. We read in verse 4. In verse 3, Gomer was to stay sequestered for, quote-unquote, many days. Now in verse 4, Israelites must be many days without king or priest. Now, of course, Hosea was talking about northern Israel, which went down in 722, but if you include southern Israel and start in 586 when they went down, Israel has been preserved. They don't do idolatry anymore, but they don't have any more prophets. They don't have any priestly sacrifice in the temple, and they don't have any king. And that's been going on from 586, or actually, we've got to take in account the return from Babylon. They reestablished the second temple. But then that went down in 8070. So let's just take 8070. From 8070 to the year 2023, as I speak, the Jews have existed. The Jewish religion remains, and yet they are without prophet, they are without priest, and they are without king. And so Hosea's prophecy has been fulfilled to the letter. Now, in verse 4, the Israelites are said to be facing a future without sacrifice or sacred pillar. Sacred pillar means idolatry, illegal idol worship. That's in parallel with sacrifice, which was legal worship. Now, let me read you a quote from a pulpit commentator about this lack of idolatry in the midst of the Jews. Quote, "What attaches special importance to this remarkable passage is the undeniable fact that these predictions were uttered not only before the dissolution of the monarchy and the cessation of sacrifices, but at a time when no human sagacity could foresee and no human power foretell the future abstention of the Hebrew race from idol worship so long practiced and from heathenish divination resorted to from such an early period of their history." In other words, Hosea was prophesying in the 8th century B.C. The Israelites were currently practicing idolatry. They had practiced idolatry ever since the golden calf. They loved idols. They'd been doing it forever. And yet Hosea predicted no more idols. Many days with no idols, many days has turned into year after year after year after year since 586 B.C. I'm going to give you a quote from a medieval Jewish rabbi who acknowledges that the Jews have no prophet, priest, and king, but who also no longer practice idolatry. This is from David Kimchi. He's a famous medieval Jewish rabbi, lived from 1160 to 1235. He says this, "These are the days of the exile in which we are this day," that's in the 1200s, or 12th or 13th century A.D., "these are the days of the exile in which we are this day, and we have neither king nor prince of Israel, for we are in the power of the Gentiles, and in the power of their kings and princes. No sacrifice to God and no statue for worshippers of idols." So they have no king, and they have no sacrifice, they have no priest, and no ephod which shall declare future things, and no prophet, priest, and king. No ephod which shall declare future things by Urim and Thummim, and no teraphim for idolaters which declare the future according to the notion of those who believe in them. And thus we are this day in this exile, all the children of Israel. And so even a Jewish rabbi realized that Hosea was prophesying of times way beyond Hosea's time. We go now to Hosea chapter 3, verse 5, and we will finish this chapter. "Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. And they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days." Now, when will this return occur? Afterward, the sons of Israel will return. When? When Israel turns to Jesus the Messiah, as John Gill says. How do we know that? "Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king." Well, David's long been dead when Hosea was prophesying, so how could the Israelites of the future seek David their king? Well, it's because David the king refers to Jesus Christ the Messiah, as Adam Clark and the pulpit commentators say. Here's what the pulpit commentator says, quote, "The patriarch David was long dead and buried, and his sepulcher was in Palestine at the time when the prophet wrote. One, therefore, in the Davidic line, a descendant from and dynastic representative of the patriarch, must be meant. That this was Messiah, there can be no reasonable doubt." I don't have a reasonable doubt. Of course it's the Messiah. Jesus was in the house of David, and so when you talk about David, you're talking about Jesus. Now here's some scriptures that are quoted by the pulpit commentator to show that David refers to the Messiah. In other prophets, Ezekiel 34, verse 23, "I will appoint over them a single shepherd, my servant David, and he will shepherd them. He will tend them himself, and he will be their shepherd." That's a messianic reference to Jesus. Ezekiel 37, verse 24, "My servant David will be king over them, and there will be one shepherd for all of them. They will follow my ordinances and keep my statutes and obey them." Jeremiah 30, verse 9, "They will serve the Lord their God, and I will raise up David their king for them." The pulpit commentator also adds that many Jewish rabbis say that David refers to the Messiah. So they understand the reference to the Messiah. They just are confused as to who the Messiah is. Now there's another view that says that David, their king, is Zerubbabel, that Hosea is referring to the return after Babylon in 538 or so B.C. The problem with that is Zerubbabel wasn't a king. He was a governor. The pulpit commentator denies strongly that Zerubbabel is meant here, and I agree with that. They, that's the Jews, will come trembling to the Lord, to Yahweh, and his goodness in the last days, of course, of the Jewish polity, which went down in AD 70, and right around that time when Jesus came, he was crucified in AD 30, people started coming to the Lord. They came trembling because they knew that their Messiah had come, trembling with appreciation and joy. Notice how last days does not mean the end of the world here. Of course, you can make it do that if you're a futurist. Many futurists do that, I'm sure. But that takes away all the fun for us in the church. I do not believe the church is a parenthesis. I do not believe it is a gap. I do not believe it's a prelude to that great millennial reign in the future. I believe the church is the object of Old Testament prophecy, and I believe the church is the object here of Hosea's prophecy. And with that theological opinion having been delivered, we are now prepared to go to Hosea chapter 4, which I will entitle, The Lord Accuses Israel. I hope you stay tuned with me for that exposition, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.